fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Welcome to the Rodcast. I'm your host, Dr. Rod. So my guest today is a physician and healthcare leader whose 20-year career has taken him from the front lines of emergency rooms in South Africa to managing hospitals in the Democratic Republic of Congo. His work focuses on healthcare design and looks at how to truly capture the patient's voice within the architectural process. He's done some stints in Indonesia, China, now Canada, and that has led him to think of patients through the lens of human stories within a system so that we can really design facilities and services that aren't just more efficient, but more equitable, safe, and compassionate. It's my pleasure to welcome my good friend, Dr. Giuseppe Murray. Giuseppe, welcome to the Rodcast.
Thank you, Rod. Thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to our chat.
Yes, I've been looking forward to this for a long time now. I remember we used to have this ritual where on Fridays, I don't know if you remember, we'd play tennis and then we would somehow find a beer in the middle of the island that was impossible to find beers in Papua. And then we'd have a really fun chat. And yeah, I always remember those conversations because they were always so stimulating and interesting. And that was so long ago that I've been looking forward to this for a while.
Yeah, one of my fondest memories from Papua was us going on a fishing trip and lying on top of the roof of the boat and just talking about the world and everything in it. It was great.
Yeah, that was really fun. It was definitely the wrong boat for fishing because I think it was too big. And did we ever catch anything?
We managed to catch quite a significant amount of fish, and you prepared ceviche the night afterwards for all of the people. So it was actually great.
But we only got like little fishes, didn't we?
It was little.
Yeah, those little tiny fishes. But yeah, I mean, you work with what you can get.
You do.
Great times. So where should we start? I think maybe probably the best place to start is if we, maybe just for the people out there, tell us a little bit about your background and how you got started into health and kind of your trajectory, if you don't mind.
So I'm a physician by training, and over the last 20 years, I've gradually migrated from working in emergency rooms in South Africa, working in internal medicine, and then working in remote communities, remote sites on various mines all around the world, The last posting being in the Democratic Republic of the Congo during COVID. So where we had we're under lockdown for 9 months and transforming the healthcare on site there to accommodate and the surge in COVID cases. So very interesting. And then after that, so I met my wife on site there, and I immigrated with her to Canada. And then I had this opportunity to rethink, okay, what's the direction I would like to take, taking in mind all of my experience in healthcare. And I decided to do a master's degree in healthcare facilities through University College London to better design healthcare from patient right through to the hospital. So thinking about everything. So having a systematic approach instead of the fractured healthcare system that we currently face. And it was fantastic, this experience, to be able to rethink and to just research everything. So over the last couple of years, whilst I was busy doing the master's, I could read anything and everything that's healthcare and design related and healthcare service related, which was a wonderful experience. And it broadened my appreciation for how complex healthcare service delivery is. I know that you've got a lot of experience from the public health big picture as well as implementation side, and the struggles that we've got to connect patients on their journey from birth to how you grow up, where you grow up, social determinants of health, to gaining access to health, to the facility where you get health care you need, making sure that you've got the right facility, the right equipment, the right people, and connecting service delivery to the patient's needs. Thinking about that and thinking of the wicked problem that healthcare delivery is and how to solve it. This was basically the last 3 years of my life, just deep diving into it and trying to figure out how can we do what we do better.
So you obviously practiced in healthcare facilities in South Africa and Papua Indonesia and DRC. What other countries am I missing?
China.
So,
yeah. And now Canada as well. Yeah.
So you've seen different iterations of what a healthcare system looks like. Do you remember the moment you thought, okay, this is broken and I need to fix it? Or what was that moment where you thought, okay, this is what I'm interested in pursuing?
I can just tell you one of the most profound, heart-wrenching, gut-wrenching memories that I've got was when I toured the DRC in 2013 in Goma province. So it's up north where the rebel incursions and fighting are taking place at the moment. To evaluate healthcare for a mining site there, but part of evaluating care was also to go and have a look at all of the healthcare facilities in the region. And they took me to the provincial hospital. And the provincial hospital were three standing buildings. A tree has fallen onto the middle part of one of the buildings 5 years prior to me getting there. And there was a Land Rover that was converted into an ambulance that looked brand new, but the tires were deflated and it hasn't run for 2 years because they didn't have the gasoline, the money to buy gasoline to operate. So when we talk about budget cuts, there were no budget, there was nothing. And I was touring there and they showed me the maternity ward. And the beds were two mothers lying on one single bed with their babies. And the beds were stacked as close as you could possibly stack it. And then they took me to the operating theater where a cesarean section was busy taking place. And it was actually, it's just a
You're listening to a podcast right now, driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own podcast is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads just like this. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start your new podcast for free today at RSS.com.
Separate room that's separate from the rest to separate the flow. And there was a mother lying on the bed, a surgeon trying to save her life, and another doctor trying to save the life of the baby just born. And you could see people so desperately trying to succeed, trying to care, trying to make a difference, but not having the required support and the required facility and infrastructure to be able to do it. And we're not talking about miraculous money. We're not talking about miraculous amount of infrastructure. We're just talking about having political stability so that people can enact the change over a longer time period. And that region didn't have that. Because once you are able to invest in your future, you can get people together to say, okay, well, let's build something that's a bit bigger. What else do we need for the community? And then you can invest in the infrastructure. You can organize and you can grow the care capability. So that was a profound moment where I knew I need to make a difference, and I need to make the difference not just by being a doctor in an isolated room or seeing one patient at a time. I need to make a difference that's systemically changing the way that we provide care and the way that we equitably distribute capital and the way that we structure and our political environment and safety for people growing up anywhere in the world. And that moment will stay with me the rest of my life. Whenever I feel things are tough, I just focus on that moment and think, this is what I want to be different. This is what I want to change. And change happens there, but it also happens in the US. That's where there are insurmountable challenges at the moment and has been for quite some time with regards to healthcare and how we invest in our populations and the care we provide. So it's a global problem that we are facing, which we need to think differently about. And it's not the most expensive things that make the difference. And we're going to talk about how I was forced to think differently about maternity care and the specific for the US, because that was part of my dissertation for the master's degree in UCL. And we can interrogate data and reimagine how we can deliver care and bring it about in a way that's not the most expensive way. It's a better, more equitable way to do it.
So I'm very curious. In my head, the first thing that comes to mind is forever you've had a system where it's not built for the user, which is the patient, because the patient goes in, they see a doctor and they say, oh, you need this lab test, you need this other study. And then once you have the results of that, you go to this other doctor that's a specialist in this area, and then this other specialist in this area. And if you're super lucky, you can even do that in the same place. More likely, you'll have to go to travel to another doctor and all the rest. And so in my mind, the only examples I've come across recently are I can't remember which country it was, but they had this new pediatric hospital where the mother and the kid, the family and the kid would come in to the hospital, and all the doctors would come to them. Like, they just stayed there and they didn't have to go anywhere. So if they needed, you know, lab work, if they needed an oncologist, if they needed whatever, nutritionist, they'd come to them. It was a slightly different setup. And then the other one is the architectural design of the actual clinic. So I remember when I was trying to design referral hospitals in Moldova and working with the architect, thinking about, okay, where do you put the rooms so that's for the patient, like, flow and all of it. But all of that obviously takes money to do. So what's some of the things that you learned on how you, as you said, don't need to break the bank and spend, that can improve that sort of that process, the outdated system?
So what we've got a lot of is data. So the dissertation I did that was which population group has got the most data that's underutilized to provide service that's tailored to the specific patient that is human-centered. So specific, these are your needs. How can we provide service to you? And data-wise, the US has got an insane amount of data on maternity, mortality, pregnancy-related. So if you think about pregnancy, it's a nine-month journey with a start, it's and an end, and you've got multiple data points all through this nine-month journey. And then you've got, at the end of it, a structured report for all of the outcomes that's captured and that's sent to the CDC, amongst other places. So you've got your birthing data that's collated and it's collected and it's quite resource rich. And we actually don't use it to improve the service. But if you think that with regards to planning healthcare for patients, you've got this 9 month period during which you can identify the risks and you can appropriately plan for the intervention or for the birth itself. And what I was thinking about is, okay, so we've got the maternity patients. Can I deep dive the data, identify subgroupings that will elucidate the different trajectories and journeys for different patients? And the idea of doing that is that you identify the possible extremes so that you can design for the mean.
So Giuseppe, I have a question for you. I've seen somewhere that the country that spends the most money on healthcare in the world is now really falling behind in probably one of the easiest and most reliable ways to measure the performance of healthcare, which is maternal.
You're listening to a podcast right now, driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own podcast is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads just like this. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start your new podcast for free today at RSS.com.
Mortality. And I've seen that the U.S. is going in the wrong direction in terms of they're having worse rates. First of all, is that true? And do you have any idea why?
Yes. So Threneet published a study in 2022 where they looked at the last 30 years of U.S. data for maternal mortality. And from 1987 to 2018, it has more than doubled. So from 7.2 to 17.4 4 deaths per 100,000 live births, which is insane. So the rest of the world, this is improving. And the US, for reasons that we can go into, has slipped down the slippery slope and is now really underperforming. On top of this, so if you give birth in the US, 1 out of 5 live births will experience at least one adverse pregnancy outcome. If you go into this, and for something that is one of the most normal things, a profound personal experience, if someone tells you before the time, there's a 20% chance that you will experience an adverse pregnancy outcome, I wouldn't be too happy about these odds. In April last year, you had an interesting podcast with Dr. Derek Yak.
Listened to it.
I'm sure you remember that. He's worked for the WHO published research and guidelines on smoking and the impact on your health of sugar and salt and food content. And I mean, it's the dedication that he's shown and the push to get this published and changed. It had a global impact, changed governmental health policies and legislation. And the important take home from that podcast for me was how he followed the data. There's a concept that I want to link that's important, because we'll discuss personas as a archetype for patient demographic groupings that encapsulates the patient's needs and healthcare wants and expectations. Whilst reading up during my studies a concept of the zip code healthcare outcomes crossed my desk. I don't know if you're familiar on that.
I'm not sure it's the same thing, but in the US, they have zip codes, which in the UK would be like postcodes. And the US is, I would say, probably different to the UK, more similar to Mexico, in the sense that just by knowing what somebody's zip code, postcode is, you can pretty much know everything about them, how they're going to vote, their income level, their ethnicity, and it's a really good predictor of so many other things.
That's spot on. Yeah. So a person's zip code is one of the most powerful predictors of their health outcomes, even more significant than genetics and individual clinical care in many cases. And this is because the zip code, as you said, encapsulates the social determinants of health. Factors like access to healthcare, healthy food, clean environments, jobs, quality of education, safe housing, and community resources. And the Dr. Derek Yak, the research that they did, especially if you have a look at salt and sugar, ultra-processed foods high in salt and sugar content. And he talks about the taste profiles and how it pushes people to eat more and how that's detrimental. And if you go to the zip code, then if you grow up in a poor, under-resourced environment or a neighborhood, then you're more likely to eat these kinds of fast foods, for lack of a better term, fast foods that's high in sugar content, high in salt content, and that are detrimental to your health. And if we circle this back to maternity outcomes that has deteriorated, there's a trend that where the hypertensive disease during pregnancy is gradually going up, obesity across the board has gone up in the US, sedentary lifestyle is a massive problem. All of these things impacts your health and has an impact on what your risk profile during pregnancy would be. And pregnancy, even though it's the most normal experience that most women go through in their lives, and it's an experience that has got a profound stress event on the body. There's ligament changes, there's impact on the heart itself, there's changes in hormones, you've got cortisol surge responses, you've got the delivery that can be quick or very long, you potentially have got the cesarean section. Basically, just to say that we put a lot of stress and strain on a body for a prolonged period of time. And during your whole pregnancy, you might develop gestational diabetes, or you might develop pregnancy-induced hypertension, or even preeclampsia, which all three of these links to later in life, the outcomes that you might experience, both in cardiac risk, cancer risk, and other risks in your later life. So you go through a stress event that uncovers what your body basic state is like and predicts how your future health will be. So for pregnant women, I believe that the deterioration in maternal mortality and health outcomes across the board is actually an early predictor of what we can expect for the US population going forward with chronic diseases. And I'm willing to take anyone on to argue the counterpoint, but I really believe that this is the case and this will be shown. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting that you say that. I had the honor and good fortune of closing a conference last week that was on the Determinants of Health and Disease conference. And it was fantastic, the research that they presented during the conference. And a lot of it essentially was looking at early stage factors and how that translates to disease later in life. And the research was mostly done, a lot of it done pregnant women. And they were looking at cohorts. So the overall message of the entire conference was basically, if we know that obesity levels are skyrocketing everywhere in the world, we know hypertension is skyrocketing, chronic disease is, you know, going to break the bank, we should really be focusing on this population, pregnant women, and then first 1,000 days of life, which I thought was fascinating.
I couldn't agree more. Definitely that it makes a lot of sense to me. Yeah.
Mm. And so, I mean, going back to your area of interest, what would you say is the low-hanging fruit of how to rethink some of these healthcare systems, hospitals, clinics, where we don't focus so much on the disease, the machines, the infrastructure, but more on the person walking in the door, like the pregnant mother?
Very interesting question. So thinking about how we redesign the healthcare systems, one of the most profound ideas I had was actually that the way we interpret our data and represent the data can be one of the biggest enablers to get everyone on board and working in the same direction and understanding what the problems are and what the patient population is that we want to be catering. In the, I think, end of the 70s, there was a research study that was published. It's not healthcare related. It was actually published by two professors, and I cannot remember it now, but with regards to natural history museum and the artifacts in the museum. And they talked about, they coined the term boundary objects. And a boundary object being a artifact or object that everyone agrees upon. It's like they see it the same way, but with your different specialities, you add different interpretations of what you see and you bring a richness to it. A boundary object might be the Rosetta Stone. And a Rosetta Stone, everyone agrees, this is the Rosetta Stone. It is a stone sculpture. It's got these different languages on it. It stems from this area. This was the purpose of it. But you've got archaeologist that's got an opinion. You've got a linguist that's got an opinion. You've got anthropologists that's got an opinion. The historians that's got an opinion. Yet they all agree about the same object. But when you throw them in a room together, they start to solve bigger problems. They start to communicate about the same object, but they synthesize their rich tapestry of information and experiences and can bring about a bigger opinion, a bigger understanding of the object at hand. Data, if you think about data, if most people think about data, they think about the Excel spreadsheet, which is one of the driest forms in which you can possibly present anything. If you take it up a notch, then you think about graphs. And graphs, a lot of time, they can be a misrepresentation of the underlying data as well. So people quite often argue about what the graph says. What I've tried to accomplish with the dissertation that I did is synthesize the data into a format that forms a boundary object that's accessible to clinicians that provides care, architects that design the hospital facility, the system designers for healthcare, the public health people, and the patients themselves. And how I did it was by creating 8 personas that broadly represents the data of maternity data for the US. And they're not random, they're a deliberate portfolio of human experience, each highlighting different clinical, demographic, and emotional journeys through the healthcare system. The idea of this was that if you can encapsulate what kind of care is necessary, and it is based on the underlying data, so it's supported by data, then you can better design your healthcare facilities that for the specific patient population that you're seeing in the environment where you're building your new facility or where you're redesigning your new facility. Circling back to the zip code, you can say, okay, well, for our city, we require XYZ. To give you an idea, if we think about the US, you jump to a conclusion, okay, well, all the cities are sort of the same, or you say, okay, well, we've got red states, we've got blue states, but to really show how different it can be, I just took 3 different cities. So Chicago, Illinois, Seattle, Washington, and San Antonio, Texas. And to illustrate the variation in demographics, I compared these.
So now you know exactly what populations and the profile of the populations are having XY issue, i.e. preterm, births, high blood pressure during pregnancy. So you know the issues, you know who's having those issues. And then you know, planning wise, what you need to do to address those issues. What's the next step?
Yeah, exactly. So now I want you to reflect the last 5 minutes, how boring the data was. Like me reciting the stats to you, I'm sure that we lost half of the listeners. and this is actually the problem that I wanted to address. It's like, this is superbly boring. Like, data is boring. No one cares about reading it. You need to tell a story, something that grips you and something that's memorable. To this end, I thought, okay, well, let's represent the data in personas. So let's make it about people that you can remember. So how about we split all of the data up into, and I chose 8 personas just because of limitation of how much space I had in one dissertation. Ideally, you can tailor it per city and make it more or less. But I thought 8 personas, will, as a proof of concept, showcase how you can reimagine data in a better way. So my 8 personas, and I took it according, so different ages and different racial or ethnicities. So to give you a brief overview, this, I mean, this will read a lot better. Abby is a 15-year-old Navajo mother. She represents the challenges of youth, geographic isolation, and cultural barriers. Her story forces us to design for privacy, psychological support, and the profound emotional complexity of adoption, asking us to consider how a space can feel safe and non-judgmental. Teenage mothers are also at high risk of severe preterm delivery, chorioamnionitis, endometritis, preeclampsia, eclampsia. So that's the boring dry data versus...
Thanks for that. You just made us lose the remaining half we listeners we had.
Yeah, but so I created the personas that's easier to, you can put yourself in the shoes of that person. You can live the experience. It's a lived experience that's real.
You're listening to a podcast right now, driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own podcast is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads just like this. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start your new podcast for free today at RSS.com.
I also went and deep-dived on what narrative experiences are out there on social media of people that live the experience that's in this demographic. So Reddit, you know, but to see how they felt and how they experienced the clinical environment. And then with the 8 personas, I plotted journey maps. So for the different persona, what would be the normal course that she follows through the whole pregnancy experience? And what are the needs along the way? And so that if you've got the journey map, so you start off with the persona. So this is what your extreme cases for health needs are. And then you plot them through a journey map that the architect can then see, okay, well, it makes sense that we need to have the examining room closer to the bereavement room, or we need to have a separate space for lactation consulting.
I love that. And I'm trying to get everyone I work with to think in that mindset, because I think in medicine and public health, one of the issues we have is we have really good technical products. They're technically perfect, but many times no one uses them. So let's say a treatment guideline. It was built over 2 years. It cost $1 million to put together. You had to bring the best minds in the world on a specific topic. You put the guideline there. It could be a guideline for a clinician. It could be a guideline for someone who runs a hospital, for a health minister. 90% of the time they put it on the shelf and it collects dust. And that's one product, but there's other products that are built in public health. And what I always say to the teams I'm working with are, okay, think of the product as the new iPhone that you want somebody to buy. Like, why would somebody who already has an iPhone buy a new one? And think of those reasons. And then once you start getting into that mindset, now do it for like a clinical guideline. Like, why would somebody buy into using this new thing? So that's an exercise I rarely see in healthcare, is seeing either a policymaker at the national level, at the subnational level, that's going to buy into your concept of why you need to get people to quit smoking or why you should raise taxes on, you know, sugar sweetened beverages. Like, why are they going to buy that thing? And that's the first step, is how are you going to sell it? How are they going to buy it? And the second thing is exactly what you're saying, is the user journey is okay, walk me through every single step of the way of that purchasing process of like why they would buy that thing. And that'll give you the good hooks on where to put, you know, your effort in terms of the bells and whistles on why they're going to buy that. One of the things I learned during COVID was, because we didn't know anything initially about how you got infected with it and everything, you know, we were basically just, you know, using the information we had in terms of infection control, and then kind of making it up along the way in the very early days. And I don't think I told you this, but I was the outsourced medical director for Chanel, and Chanel moved their headquarters to London. And so they have these big boutiques, and they wanted to say, they wanted me to go in and understand the entire buyer process of everything from when somebody walks in, they have a consultation with somebody that's going to sell them something. They go try it on. They don't buy it. They put it back. They buy one thing, and then they go to pay. Like, what are the touch points where somebody could get infected, either the staff or the person buying the thing? And obviously super high stakes, because you'd have, you know, the prime minister's wife come in. The Beckhams had like their own actual room, like on the top, on the second floor, they would use. So like all those things. And the only way to do it was to actually walk through like the entire thing myself, like into the boutique, and then also walk where the staff would walk and see where they had lunch and everything. And so then what's sort of the next step? Like, you have the user personas. It's more, it leads more to empathy building. People understand, because there's a story arc behind it. Like, then what?
Can you touch on designing an iPhone or a phone, any phone? The design process there is the same. Like, they don't design for a single user. They design for a bunch of different personas that will use the iPhone in different ways. An iPhone means something different to my grandmother versus what it means to my three-year-old child. Like, he only cares about YouTube and watching YouTube on the iPhone. It's a, for me, it's a form of communication. So it's a phone plus a bit. For my grandmother, it's basically just WhatsApp. So for different people, it means different things. Like, and you have to design for the personas that you've got in mind, and so that you can make sure that everyone draws value from the product that you put out there. To give you an idea of how we fail to do it in hospitals, the lying-in hospital in New York was built in, I think it was 1905, 1915, which is a maternity hospital. It's, at that time, it was built the best new design. They pushed for scientific rigor. They provided free care to all of the immigrant mothers, and they trained the doctors as well. What it enabled was, so they built this flagship hospital, and it facilitated educating, creating a new discipline, obstetrics, which before didn't really exist. We had midwives that provided patient-centered care at the bedside in the home of a person. But they envisioned, we need to move to a different model. And the hospital is designed following the paradigm of modern industrial complexes, and specifically references Ford manufacturing in the motor vehicle industry. We, as doctors, got trained that you have the examination room, so the mother comes in, she's got her water broke, then you've got the examination room where you determine, is she in labor, is she not in labor? if she's in labor, she moves to the labor room or to a room where she can wait until she goes into labor. And it wasn't designed with the patient in mind, because now a mother, instead of being at home where she's got a lot less stress, the environment is familiar, and where she's got a maternal figure that provides advice, comfort and care in her home, and then delivers the baby. We've moved that to a stress environment where everything is clinical, it's unfamiliar, and you get moved around a lot, and you are viewed as a product. It's a production line where you come in and the doctor determines where you are going. If you're not delivering fast enough, we then give you an induction agent, or we ramp up this, or we decide that you need a cesarean section. But it's all product focused. There's no humanity in this care whatsoever. What the persona view challenges this whole paradigm, where we go, okay, let's focus on the mother and the mother's needs and what does she need. And we do this by doing thorough research. What's her risk profile like? What's her wants? What's her needs? And what would she like? And how can we create the environment that enables the best care and the best outcomes?
And so I'm just going to be difficult for a little bit.
Bring it on.
So you've worked in some of the poorest, you know, countries in the world. So what are the first things, like, the ministry, you know, public health professionals, they try to do in these countries when we're talking about pregnant women, is we want them to give birth in a clinical setting, because many times, because of culture, in some countries they do it at home, and obviously there's a risk associated with that. So you're struggling with that, is how do we convince certain populations to go to a healthcare facility? Once you achieve that, which is, you know, very difficult in some populations, then you have everything that you just talked about, how it's poorly designed, very little resources, etc. So how would we start? Like, where would we start if we're talking about a country or a location or a geographic region where we know it's probably going to be really difficult to get money to invest in redesigning the infrastructure of the hospital?
I would challenge even more and say, okay, well, the problem is not that we don't have the hospital. We want to provide people with the options of choosing the best care. And I would say that if you have a community that's very rural based, with poor access to any healthcare, then we still have, in most communities, access to the internet. And what I would push in that circumstance is not the hospital itself, but access to educational resources where any person from the community can become the local expert in antenatal and delivery care. Why don't we create the platform where you can go on an educational journey? So in those communities, there's already the maternal figure that has per chance delivered 20 babies. Or the maternal figure, there's a cultural aspect of this is how delivery takes place. This is what you should be doing.
I thought we could do a fun exercise.
Yeah.
So taking it from everything you said, so let's imagine that you and I are back in Papua and we're given the mission to go into the local community and implement, you know, some of these practices. So as you and I know, but maybe for the folks out there, there's still a lot of tribal communities, traditional practices. And so how would we go about that? So as you probably remember, like the anything you wanted to get done, you had to go to the local tribe chief and get their blessing and then get their buy-in, like, to do anything. So how would you imagine we would go about that?
There's an interesting publication, and it's actually quite old, but by Prochaska. Prochaska put forth this theoretical framework of change, patient change, like how do patients change their minds and how do they change their health behaviors? And he designed it specifically for smokers. Mm-hmm. And there's different phases that you go through. And he starts off with pre-contemplation, then contemplation, and you go through all of these phases. And the idea is that you cannot implement something if you haven't seen the need for changing. So to go back to Papua, I would say that we are the wrong people to try to implement the change. Mm-hmm. And what you need to find, you need to identify who is the possible early adopters in their local healthcare environment. So who is open-minded, who thinks differently? And then you need to ask them the questions like, how good do you think is maternal care or health care? Do you think that this is effective? Do you think there is better ways of doing this so that they can move from pre-contemplation to contemplation? Like, just is the door opening so that we can think, okay, but maybe there's something better? And then they might come up with a solution topography. Like, I think that this is a way to do it differently. And it might be cooking water before using it to wash hands. Or they might think, okay, well, I can't think of anything, but surely there must be a better way. And then you can provide the evidence or say, okay, well, different people do it differently. This is the options that you've got available. And they can start thinking about it. But it's so difficult, and I've been thinking about this, where I've gone into remote locations and pushed for the implementation of my ideas without recognizing how I'm viewed from their perspective. Mm. And if you are viewed as a pushy know-it-all, no one's going to listen to you, nor are they going to implement what you're saying. You don't have the authority. You don't have the stature. They don't believe in you. You don't even fall within the hierarchy of how they view people. Like, you're a complete outsider. Why would anyone trust an outsider to tell them how to be doing things if they've been doing things the same way for a long period of time? And this is where healthcare is a very complex system. It's not just pushing for the current most advanced solutions.
You're listening to a podcast right now, driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own podcast is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads just like this. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start your new podcast for free today at rss.com.
To care. It's understanding how to implement it at the local level and understanding that implementation is useless if you don't have the buy-in from people, if you don't have people actually thinking there's a need to change. And implementation is doubly useless if you don't reinforce this behavior or you don't get it to become part of the way that we do things, if that answers your question there.
So I think increasingly we're living in a society where maybe the evidence in the science is not regarded as strongly as it used to be, you know, 20 years ago. And just because there's lots of data and science that proves that it's probably true, doesn't necessarily mean that the decision maker is going to go forward with that. What do you see is a viable way where we can overcome that, where we're living in a world that's increasingly less impressed and persuaded by the actual numbers?
Yeah, there's something that's superbly disconcerting to me. one of the most horrible phrases that we've invented is alternative truths, which for some reason people value, you know, almost equivalently because it's culturally resonating with them. But an alternative truth is a lie. That's there's no such thing as an alternative truth. And I think we are fighting disinformation on a scale that we're not prepared for. Like that's actually the fundamental problem we're struggling with, is that social media, but also the internet at large, has given us access to a wealth of information, but also access to a wealth of garbage. And AI, unfortunately, is trained on a lot of data because of the narrative content. Like, it's a large language model, and they use social media as well. So some of the alternative truths are being propagated. So you can easily get AI to derail into just spouting this garbage that's fringe on either political or scientific content. To give you an example, is just the amount of information out there that's legitimate sounding on anti-vaccination. Like, where people, they've got talking points, they've got scientific studies that's not rigorously conducted, but that they quote, that tells, that they've spelt as reasons why you shouldn't get vaccinated. I think we live in this era where, because we haven't suffered major pandemics, and I'm not discounting the major pandemic that we just had, but for most people, it wasn't them falling ill. It was them being forced to get vaccinated. It wasn't them spending time in hospital. It was them being secluded in their homes. And we secluded them for 1 year, 2 year at an end. So you get angry because you get to a point where you don't care about what's the greater good. You care about being able to go out and being able to live your life. And if we think that the human being is irrational when it comes to decision making, we're making a mistake. We are inherently emotional, and we base most of our decisions on our emotions and then justify it afterwards.
How many people have won the Nobel Prize in economics for that? And I think we still don't get it in medicine. It's just the arrogance in medicine to think that if we show people the truth, that it'll be compelling enough for them to make the right decision. It's just, I really struggle to think how we're going to, as a science, how we're going to get past that.
Yeah. And you're exactly right. And what makes it worse is that we haven't moved past being paternalistic as doctors. Why should I take this medication? And it's because I told you so. And now we do it because, and then we quickly ramble off a few sentences of why this medication is good for you. But as an authoritative figure, you shouldn't be relying on this just because I told you so. It's very poor way. And it's not going to get better because we don't spend enough time with patients. There's no way you can do a proper consultation in the short period of time, 10 minutes, that you allotted per patient.
Maybe 10 minutes in Canada and in the private sector. Mexico is like 3 minutes.
Yeah. No, exactly. It's horrible. So what we're doing is so I've got a big problem with the way that we do consultations in general, because I firmly believe that the way we set it up is it's set up for failure. Like a patient comes in and this is the first time you hear their story. And it's basically 20 questions to get to a diagnosis. And then as soon as you limit it down, you ram it home and you send them out. So I don't think that you are able to elucidate the amount of data required to make a good diagnosis in that time frame. Like, you can't ask the questions, think about it, reformulate it, and expect a patient to answer in a coherent way that's structured, because it's also their first presentation for this problem, most likely. And they have to formulate it and throw into the mix cultural barriers, throw into the mix an elderly patient with dementia or elderly patient with other comorbids and problems. And now we want them to focus on one thing. So I think the way we structure it is wrong. We don't have data veracity. We don't have enough information to give the appropriate intervention plan going forward. And our intervention plan typically is a single intervention at a time instead of a holistic view of the patient.
Sorry to interrupt, yeah. But on that point, on the other hand, just to play devil's advocate, I don't know if you read the book Nexus. Yeah, it's Harari's book, last book. But one of the things I thought he mentioned that's interesting is he says that having more data is actually going to be worse, because the amount of time, money, energy fishing out the truth when you have more data becomes a lot harder. And what that made me think was, immediately my mind went to like wearables. And you know, a very quick example, like continuous glucose monitoring, where you put, you know, the patch on your arm, you attach it to your phone, and you can see in real time, like your glucose levels spiking and dipping and whatnot. I like to guinea pig everything. So I tried it for 2 months.
Yeah.
And because it was like a big trend that was coming in the UK, like, oh, you know, everybody needs to be on this and whatnot. And yeah, it was pretty useless, I have to say. I didn't really learn anything. But I think increasingly, like with these types of technologies, it's going to get harder. I mean, I think for sure AI will probably help us out here, but I think you're going to have so many more data points that fleshing out the truth is going to be really a lot harder. And I'm kind of worried, because I kind of see this with the zeitgeist and like the culture wars going on everywhere in the world, where it's becoming really hard to know what the actual truth is. Like, even in my own personal experience, you know, Lauren was looking at her phone and she was looking at some of the events like in the UK that happened over the weekend. Her algorithm is completely different to mine. And so what she was seeing on her news channels was 180 like opposite view of what I was seeing of the same event. And I don't know, I don't know how I feel about that, but I'm a little bit worried.
I completely agree with you, and I'm gonna add oil on this fire. So data picking has been going on as long as there has been pharmaceutical companies or any health care diagnostic or research companies wanting to push their product or advance their stature. And we've seen this in pharmaceuticals where parallel randomized control trials will be launched. And then if you launch enough of them, you can actually kill the ones off that don't prove your point. And they silently die. And you just push the one that's actually, so you push the tail end outlier of the bell curve that proves your drug is successful. And you push it just enough so that you can advance it to the next phase and to the next phase. And then you market it in a way so that it gets an adoption. And so yes, that's where big data is our adversary, because you can pick and choose whatever you want to prove your point. And yes, it is definitely a concern, and you're right.
So just to end on a positive note, you know, whether it's, you know, data or AI or whatever it might be, as somebody that's thinking about maybe the future of, you know, your kid, what excites you about the world and in the future that, you know, they're going to live in?
Okay, so despite our conversation just about all of about science not being taken seriously and I actually think access to information is way better than it's ever been. And the ability to synthesize massive amounts of data and individualize it to your needs are astounding. I'm specifically thinking about the revolution that's going to hit education, where we know that neurodivergent populations people that mainstream in school struggle because they aren't catered to. And there's an interesting book that I actually just ordered from Amazon that likens neurodivergent people in the workforce as the canary in the coal mine, where if you don't take to heart what they're telling you about their difficulties in the workplace, you're actually not listening to what everyone else in the workplace is experiencing, but not able to put a finger on. Because everyone struggles with ambient noise or disruptive sound systems or the air conditioning that's either too hot or too cold, or that's not providing aircon everywhere, or bad light or fluorescent light instead of natural light, or like the workplace is not necessarily designed to be the best place to work in, which is ironic. We design and build it with cheap alternatives to what the ideal solution would be. But neurodivergent people have got such a unique experience of it that they actually are able to point out, listen, this is a problem. I don't like it for X, Y, Z reasons. And if you listen and cater to them, the rest of your employees will benefit from this. This is you getting free advice from an expert that's more sensitive to some of the things that bothers everyone, but other people are able to ignore even though it bothers them.
Wow.
So I think education-wise, if we cater and we are able to design individualized learning plans, then it's going to benefit everyone. And we are able to implement this by utilizing large language models and artificial intelligence to guide students through the learning process and to tailor the learning process so that it optimizes the acquisition of knowledge and the formation of critical thinking in such a way that the student learns at their fastest pace. Because we are also not just students that's struggling with learning that's getting failed by the educational system, but also your really gifted children, because they aren't able to learn at their speed. We put everyone in the same cohort that's age specific, and you in a class that depends on whether it's private or public, but classroom 20 to 35 to 50 people, depending on where you are in the world. And, you know, it's our educational system is geared just to get people to a point of enough literacy so that they can be institutionalized as workers in a production economy. It's not geared to maximize the potential that every individual brings to the table upon birth. Like we're not maximizing our talent pool at all.
That's a great sentence. That'll be the title of the podcast.
Yeah.
Well, thanks a lot, pal.
No, thank really you. It has been fun, and it's been so much fun to catch up. I really enjoy this.
Hey, thanks for listening, folks. If you enjoyed that, please hit subscribe, like, and share. See you next time.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own podcast is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads just like this. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start your new podcast for free today at RSS.com.